Notwithstanding the current severely strained overall state of the U.S.-China relationship, the interconnected fields of climate and energy are generally viewed by both countries as potentially fruitful and mutually beneficial areas of collaboration. U.S. and Chinese efforts, along with those of other nations, were central to the reaching of the historic Paris Climate Accord. And indeed, prospects for progress on the issue of climate change are dim, absent the active involvement and leadership of the world's two largest carbon emitters. In this episode, we will converse with three contributors to, including the editor of, a new book entitled From Trump to Biden and Beyond, Reimagining U.S.-China Relations. These authors tackle the energy and climate issues in their respective chapters. My name is David Feierstein, and welcome to the Bush China Foundation podcast. Joining me today to explore these topics are Mr. Earl Carr, Dr. Carolyn Kassane, and Dr. Jackson Ewing, scholars at leading academic and business institutions across the United States. Thanks so much to each of you for joining us today.
David, thank you so very much. Really delighted to be here. And many thanks to the Bush China Foundation for hosting. And always wonderful to be with my co-authors, Earl and Jackson. Thank you.
Likewise, David. It's really a pleasure, and I look forward to our conversation.
David, thanks so much for your leadership, and it's a pleasure and honor to be here.
Before we begin, let me briefly introduce our three guests. Earl Carr is the chief global strategist at Pivotal Advisors based in New York City, as well as an adjunct instructor at New York University's Center for Global Affairs, and he is the editor of From Trump to Biden and Beyond. Dr. Carolyn Kassane serves as the academic director of the graduate programs in global affairs and global security, conflict, and cybercrime at NYU's Center for Global Affairs. She is a clinical professor, director of the SPS Energy, Climate, Justice, and Sustainability Lab, and coordinator of the Energy and Environment Concentration at the Center. Dr. Jackson Ewing is a senior fellow at Duke University's Nicholas Institute of Environmental Policy Solutions, adjunct associate professor at the Sanford School of Public Policy, faculty lead for the Duke Kunshan University Environment Program, and senior advisor to the Asia Society Policy Institute. Let's start with a brief overview of the fascinating book that all of you were so integral to producing. And perhaps I'll start with Earl to say a few words about how the book came about, and also to ask each of you to share a little bit about what your contributions to the book were.
Thank you, David. So I had the privilege of serving in the Biden campaign, and I served in the East Asia Working Group. And it was about subsequently after Biden had won the election, I had published an article in Forbes, and a publisher at Paul Graves Macmillan read one of the articles and reached out to me. He just happened to be an alumni from the College of William Mary, and so that was even great. So both being alumni, he reached out and said, "Hey, have you ever thought of publishing a book on China?" And I said, "You know, I'd love to do that, but don't have the time or energy or wherewithal, I think, to really commit to something like this." And he said, "Look, why don't you think about doing an edited volume?" And I thought of immediately the extraordinary work that Carolyn Kassane has done on oil and a variety of other geopolitical issues, as well as my very good friend and colleague, Jackson Ewing. And so reached out to them and a few other scholars. And 9 months later, here we are. So that's the backstory, David.
That's wonderful. That's great. And could each of you maybe share a little bit about what you focused on in your chapters and what some of your major conclusions were?
Sure. I think the first chapter, looking at how does China and the United States both compete and cooperate in this new intersection of innovation and manufacturing, was the key centerstone for chapter one, and just laying the center stage for, you know, how the United States and China have always historically competed and cooperated. And I think we're in a real inflection point now as China has significantly enhanced both its military, political, economic, and social prowess. And I think that, you know, the chapter helps to frame how and why China in the United States and should cooperate with each other. And I think one of the quintessential lessons learned from the first chapter is that there is a significant cost to both governments, society, and businesses and nonprofits alike when the United States and China do not actively cooperate. And so that's a key cornerstone that we wanted our colleagues in the audience to take away from the first chapter.
That's great. Yeah, Carolyn?
Sure. Well, thank you. Yeah, so my chapter very much sort of dives into the U.S.-China, both its energy relationship and just giving what is happening in the energy space. And I really leave it to Jackson to sort of dive deeper into climate, although I do address China's climate policies and sort of what that's going to mean for its future energy demand. But I really bring up and hopefully bring out the issue of complex interdependence. The US and China are the two biggest players in global energy markets. China has surpassed the United States as the largest importer of oil. Much of that oil, 40% of it, is coming from the Middle East. In addition, China is, its economic system is very entangled with its energy consumption. So this idea that there is no such thing as going it alone when it comes to energy, there's no such thing as complete energy independence. So how the United States and China cooperate, or again, how they each either support each other, but also recognizing that, you know, the United States sees China as a very important market for its own shale oil, as well as liquefied natural gas. What China does with regards to its own energy policies moving forward is a is what many analysts, it's what keeps them up at night, because, you know, the direction that China takes around climate policy, around what its decisions will be in terms of electric vehicles, means a lot for what their own oil demand, what their natural gas demand will be. They are, as I said, they are the giant in the energy room. They have also become the green giant because of their emphasis on building out renewable energy technologies. And they are a manufacturing giant for those renewable energy technologies. So I really just wanted to sort of, you know, bring forward this very complex interplay as it relates to energy. And also how, when it comes to climate, again, you know, Jackson will be talking more about it, is that, you know, you do find alignment or in a kind of a similar type of narrative about the pledges that are being made by both the United States and by China.
Thanks so much, Carolyn. Really appreciate that. Jackson, let's hear from you as well, please.
Thank you. Caroline provides me an excellent segue here. I attempt in my chapter to contextualize the U.S.-China climate change relationship and do so really through looking at its modern history and asking where that places us in our current moment. And there are a few phases of that history that I think are instrumental for developing that kind of understanding. A relatively long phase from the beginning of international climate change response efforts in the early and mid-1990s, well into the 2000s, saw the U.S. and China at such pronounced loggerheads on climate change that it really impeded the sort of progress that we needed to be making during that era. And the fracture point centered primarily around disagreements about the respective responsibilities to respond to climate change by both countries. The U.S. arguing that without getting major developing countries on board and committed to binding and ambitious climate change mitigation targets, that is, greenhouse gas emissions reduction targets, that the international efforts from developed countries would ultimately not only be ineffective for responding to climate change, but create an unlevel playing field in which their industries were at comparative disadvantages to those which were able to face less stringent climate change regulations in developing countries and singling out China in particular among those developing countries as the essential member of that grouping that really needed to move forward were the U.S. to also move forward in kind. China, meanwhile, made the argument that as a developing country, its culpability for the climate change problem was substantially less than countries like the United States, those in Europe, and even some East Asian peers like Japan, and that it must focus on its own domestic development, poverty eradication, electrification, et cetera, and that to the extent that it would embark on more ambitious climate change response strategies, it needed resources and allowances for doing so. And that story began to shift a bit during the second term of the Obama administration and a realization in China that addressing climate change dovetailed with broader goals on transforming its economy and perhaps even more importantly, addressing conventional pollution at home. And that opening in the mid-2010s is what led to this flurry of bilateral cooperation on climate, which, David, you referred to implicitly in your opening remarks in speaking, I think, quite correctly to the fact that it was that bilateral convergence that in many ways made the Paris Agreement on climate change, which continues to guide international efforts, possible and helped to shape the form that it ultimately took. Now, since then, things have changed quite a lot. The decision by the Trump administration to withdraw from the Paris Agreement showed a lack of durability in the U.S. position internationally and in the eyes of China specifically. Meanwhile, China's environmental and climate record in the years since Paris has been mixed, with areas of substantial ambition tempered with concerns around an ongoing confronting emissions profile, which speaks in many ways to what Caroline has just described on its energy planning. And that brings us to our current moment with questions surrounding what the opportunities are for climate change cooperation under the Biden administration and what sort of pragmatic shapes might it take.
Thanks so much, Jackson. And I want to pick up on this topic of energy. And in a little while, we'll talk also about climate change as well. But looking at the issue of energy, how do each of you assess the degree to which U.S. and Chinese priorities and aspirations in the energy area converge or diverge? In other words, is there a complementarity between what the United States and China are trying to do in the energy space? And more specifically, what is your assessment of the future of energy trade between the United States and China? It seems to many of us like it is a potential win-win, and yet it also seems that perhaps the two countries are underperforming their potential in terms of energy trade. Would love to get your thoughts on these questions.
Sure. I'll go ahead and start. I think it's a great question. I think it's critically important to understand that energy and trade need to be, within the context of climate change, need to be these anchor issues in U.S.-China relations. And I want to just bring back to something that Jackson had mentioned. You know, when you look at how prominently the climate change factored into the Obama administration, you know, when all else failed on collaboration on economics, on trade, you know, at least we had climate change that both countries could focus on and say, you know, we understand that this is a win-win situation and this kind of will continue to anchor the Sino-US relationship. And I think we're in a similar inflection point today in the current Biden administration, where both the US and China are kind of in a foggy territory trying to, you know, they're in the ocean and they don't have a compass and there's huge fog and both are trying to find its way. And so I think, you know, if we have these areas where we can have an anchor kind of component where both countries commit to a specific issue like climate change, like energy and trade, I think that we'll have more predictability within the relationship. But more importantly, when we have crises, as we've seen in a variety of different experiences, you know, these help us get back to the negotiating table, so to speak.
I'm going to jump in on a very pragmatic level. The reality is that, you know, something that I address in my chapter, you know, China and the United States kind of has had it, kind of an all of the above strategy. And, you know, if you look at China's energy mix, of course, it uses a lot of coal. It's over 56% of its overall energy consumption. It's using a fair amount of gas, and it seeks to increase its gas consumption from 8.7% today to 18% by 2030. It uses a lot of petroleum. This is not just for the transportation sector, but also for petrochemicals and liquefied petroleum gases. So there's a tremendous opportunity for the United States and China to work more closely together. I think everyone in your audience knows that the United States is a very large producer of both oil and gas, and U.S. producers seek international markets. And of course, China being one of the largest markets, emerging, growing market in gas, that it does make sense that there be a stronger relationship on the trade of both oil and gas. And we already see it, right? Even in the, you know, in the phase one deal, even under, you know, very challenging conditions under Trump, with regards to the narrative that, you know, energy played a big part of phase one, you know, China agreeing to purchase about $50 billion worth of energy-related products. They have not met that obligation, but I do think as the relationship shifts, pivots to a more pragmatic relationship, I think there is a great opportunity for the United States and for China to both benefit, one, from the United States' energy production and China's growing demand. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of demand that's still happening in China. And I hope that we'll get a few minutes to talk about, you know, China's current situation where, you know, we're seeing some shortages in the country. We're seeing some industrial stoppages because they don't have enough. Actually, they're looking to bring on more coal. There's also a lot of concern about the coming winter. Winter is coming, and whether or not they're going to have enough gas. So if you think about all these risks that China confronts with regards to its own domestic energy security, you know, the United States is in a good position if they, you know, can do so. Both, again, on the energy side, it's predominantly private companies in the United States, but they definitely want to sell their energy to China.
Let me just note that at the Bush China Foundation, we care a lot about the issue of energy, and we're headquartered in Houston. And of course, Houston's the energy capital of the world. And one of the things that we have, one of the ideas that we have put forward over the last couple of years is the idea of a U.S.-China Energy Free Trade and Investment Agreement, as we call it, EFTIA or FTIA. And it's the idea of basically taking energy out of the trade war and fast-tracking energy as an area where there could be and should be arguably mutually beneficial trade that generates a win-win for all involved. And so that's an area that we continue to work on. And I hope we may have opportunities to collaborate with you around some of that work as we go forward. But let me shift the conversation now to climate. Many observers of the bilateral relationship continue to point to climate as an area, and perhaps the area, holding the greatest potential for U.S.-China collaboration at this moment. Jackson, your chapter, Pathways for U.S.-China Climate Cooperation under the Biden Administration, describes the history of bilateral climate cooperation, and you talked about that a little bit earlier in the show, suggesting that it's really developed within the last decade, albeit with some setbacks along the way. Given the history and the leaderships now in place in both countries, how do you assess the prospects for climate cooperation going forward, given how tense the overall relationship is? Or will we be able to kind of compartmentalize and really do some good work, notwithstanding the difficulties in the overall relationship?
The issue of compartmentalization on climate change is a difficult one. There is, I think, certainly a strong argument, and I largely subscribe to it, that some degree of compartmentalization on climate and a search for low-hanging fruit in areas that where compromise and cooperation was possible is what led to and undergirded some of the climate convergence during the Obama second term and under the presidency of President Xi in China. But at the same time, climate change is an issue area that touches very competitive strategic avenues of the relationship itself. We might leave security aside on that, although there are certainly intersections of climate and security, and that was recently debated at the UN Security Council, another place where the US and China hold different views on the climate topic. But more fundamentally, it speaks to the same sorts of issues of Chinese industrial policies and lending practices, and currency management that are at the heart of some of the U.S.-China geopolitical and geoeconomic maneuvering outside of the climate arena. So U.S. pressure on China to increase its climate ambitions is met by criticisms from China that the U.S. has not done enough of its part in funding things like the Green Climate Fund to adapt to the future challenges of climate and help poor countries mitigate against it. U.S. pressure on China to continually scale up and ratchet up its targets for emissions reductions is met with China with accusations of the U.S.'s own mixed record on that front in the current moment, not necessarily on emissions reductions, but on the movement in and out of the Paris Agreement itself. So I think that a challenge is that climate change, you know, while still in an area that both countries see as potentially fertile for cooperation and dialogue, is also an issue area that fundamentally connects to wider strategic friction and competition. So with that as a precursor, to avoid completely skirting your question, David, I will say I see promise in process here in the current moment. And by that, I mean we have witnessed since the beginning of the Biden administration and really back into the transition, an emphasis on rekindling dialogue that brings along some of the former key players that led to the progress that we saw in the previous decade. Specifically, the very overt overtures from Secretary Kerry in his new role as Special Climate Envoy to leadership in China, including Special Envoy Xi Jinhua, who was Kerry's counterpart in many ways during the mid-2010s when such progress was made, is promising for trying to get some of aspects of the relationship back on track and to find some new pathways for cooperation forward. The fact that those sorts of communications and correspondences are regularized and are formalized and are ongoing, I think gives some reason for optimism that we'll see some kind of material progress made.
If I can jump in, I think another critical component to this story, especially where I sit in Wall Street, is how are U.S. companies being able to engage with Chinese companies on cleaner energy technologies? And I remember when on President Trump's first trip to Beijing, you saw GE sign an MOU with a local Chinese company to develop clean energy technologies. And I think we need more of those types of initiatives that help strengthen Sino-US ties, particularly in the private sector. I was speaking to an investor the other day, and he said, you know, I think, you know, why is the United States investing in China? I think it's important that we not invest in their economy at all. And I said, well, look at clean energy technology. Don't you think that it would, you know, be a great opportunity for companies to be able to invest? And just given the sheer need of environmental concerns, looking at, you know, the use of coal and the air quality in China, wouldn't it be great if companies could invest and jointly develop this technology that can help, you know, over 1.4 billion people in China, but not only in that, develop that technology through other parts of the region. And so I think we're starting to see more types of, particularly the private sector and other ordinary individuals invest into funds that focus on decarbonization. There's one in particular called the CraneShares Global Carbon ETF that I'm familiar with. And I think if we continue this trend of just having more of a conversation about, you know, what are the different types of technologies that both US and Chinese companies with support from the government can focus on, I think this would greatly help both US and China in this endeavor.
I want to ask two other questions, and this next one is kind of the penultimate question, and it goes to all three of you. Jackson, in his chapter, I think, talked about subnational ties and how important that is now in the issue of climate collaboration between the United States and China. And so we see cities and states entering into agreements with China or with Chinese counterpart entities, provinces or cities, et cetera. And we've seen that in the climate area, certainly. And the question I want to ask is this a trend both in terms of climate, but also in terms of the issue of energy that we think is we're going to see more of as we go forward? And given the kind of bottlenecking that we see at the federal and central levels, is the future really more about subnational engagement, whether around the topic of climate or energy? I'd love to get your perspective on that.
David, it's a great question. I think definitely in the area of climate, I would say yes. I'm going back to what you mentioned earlier and some of the work that the Bush China Foundation is doing in terms of galvanizing a energy free trade EFTIA. I think that is a fantastic idea. I think even going into Glasgow, sort of piggybacking on what Earl had said with regards to the opportunities for the private sector and for, you know, investors in clean energy technologies, that there can be kind of easier pathways between the United States and China. And I think at the, you know, if we go back a couple of years, at least in the United States, it was very much the subnational level. Cities and states that were taking the lead on climate and that were, you know, reaching out to counterparts overseas. So I do think that there are opportunities. I mean, you sit in Texas, there are many people, many companies in Texas, right, that see significant opportunities to work in China. China also needs, you know, they're always looking to be more diversified, to never become, you know, overly dependent on one source. So I think you'll see more of that and more sort of different regions of China that could lead to some interesting agreements, interesting trade flows. So I would answer yes on the energy side and on the climate side.
Jackson, Earl, any additional comments on that point?
Sure. I'll chime in with a couple of other thoughts. First is that there have been kind of two pushes for the subnational convergence in recent history. And I think we're in a slightly different place now than we were then. One was that we had a flurry of subnational activity kind of that ran concurrent and was in part facilitated by the national level convergence in the mid-2010s. So the U.S.-China Climate Leaders Summits in 2015 and in 2016 is when we saw a number of MOU signatures between different cities and states and provinces to make some quite material cooperative investments from R&D to capacity sharing, et cetera. And a lot of that centered around the state of California and major cities in California and major cities in China and major provinces like Jiangsu. And some of that continues, and there's a legacy of work that still is ongoing, and it can take the form of targets, such as a couple of dozen American and Chinese cities, states, and provinces all committing to the Alliance for Peking Pioneer Cities, which sees peaking emissions by 2030, and also, you know, research and collaboration partnerships on things like zero emissions vehicles, citywide decarbonization through increased building efficiencies, things like that. And then we also saw during the Trump administration, on the heels of the U.S. Temporary withdrawal from the Paris Agreement, a real flurry of activity at state and municipal levels, as well as in the corporate sector, to try to remain in to the principles of the Paris Agreement. So, you know, the We Mean Business Coalition, We're Still In, et cetera, different collectives, which really attempt to present a counterpoint to the national level federal policy on that issue. And when you collectivize all of the cities, states, and businesses that were parts of those coalitions, in many cases vocal parts, it represented substantial parts of the U.S. population and economy. Now, you know, now the U.S. is back in the Paris Agreement on a federal level, and we also, you know, are looking to those same sorts of subnational cooperation opportunities. But so far in the Biden administration, of course, it's early. We haven't seen anything like what we witnessed in the mid-2010s. So, you know, I write in the chapter that I think that rekindling that sort of work, redoubling those efforts is important, and I hope that it happens. The only other thing I'll mention is outside of business and subnational governments, another category there is in the kind of epistemic and knowledge communities in research and track two diplomatic communities in the U.S. and China. And there we do see substantial cooperation with people and institutions who have helped to create, for example, emissions trading markets here in the United States, now being actively involved collaboratively with the architects of China's own national emissions trading system. Similarly, we see some knowledge and information exchange on other environmental and climate tools, renewable energy portfolio standards, et cetera, where there are often longstanding relationships that can be brought to bear, and I think will be really important for cooperation outside of that country-to-country level in its highest form moving forward.
The only thing I would add is just to, you know, be clear what one of the points that both Jackson and Carolyn mentioned, you know, when President Trump pulled out of the Paris Climate Accord, you saw immediately Governor Jerry Brown travel from the state of California, travel to Beijing and meet with President Xi and sign a deal to work on climate change. And I think that's, you know, a clear example of how on a subnational level, progress can be made even when at a federal level, you know, things are kind of, you know, might be stagnated. And I think this has important implications for something that we haven't yet talked about, which is China's Belt and Road Initiative, when from an environmental standpoint, you're gonna see millions of tons of cement, you know, go into the atmosphere on a number of large and significant infrastructure projects. And so I think the more the United States and China work together to bring awareness of how initiatives like China's BRI could have an adverse impact on China's environmental ecosystem, I think these are overall good for both China and the United States.
Let me ask a final question to each of you, maybe just for a brief response. And it's a big question. But as we look at climate change and energy issues in the U.S.-China bilateral agenda, what do each of you hope to see as we go forward over the next several years at this still transitional moment in the early months of the Biden administration? What would success look like in your judgment in these really important areas of climate collaboration and energy collaboration between the United States and China? Maybe starting with Earl and then to Carolyn and Jackson.
Sure. One, it's a great question, and it's so complex. What is interesting when you saw negotiations between China and the United States early on in the Biden administration, you saw the Chinese foreign minister articulate that China would not engage the United States on areas such as climate change unless the United States first made significant changes on U.S. policy on China's human rights records, et cetera. I think for me, I think the fact that we were able to have a discussion on climate change at a very high level on multiple frameworks signifies to me that A, we shouldn't be having preconditions. B, you know, we are able to work through those differences. And C, I think that what I would, you know, term as a win or something that we should be continually working on is that, you know, diplomacy is really difficult. We are going to have issues that come up. But just the fact that, you know, because we don't see eye to eye on policies like, human rights or trade, that should not preclude us from focusing on areas of our mutual interest. You saw last week in the Wall Street Journal, the U.S. Secretary of Commerce articulate how important it is to forge stronger economic relations between the U.S. and China, which will hopefully help in other areas, whether that be issues of areas on the South China Sea or other, you know, sticking points in the U.S.-China relationship. So I'm hopeful that in the next, you know, few years or one of the key highlights, I think, of policy will be able to have a framework that is more predictable for both the U.S. and China, which will also lead the foundation for better trade and economic cooperation, both at the private sector and at a variety of different levels. And I'll just leave one last anecdote. You know, at the zenith of the Cold War, the U.S. and Russia could not agree on who ought to have nuclear weapons, but they could agree on one quintessential point, which is they believed in eradicating polio. And you saw for the first time scientists from the United States and Russia work together, and they were able to eradicate polio for the first time. And I think if the United States and China are able to focus on a singular goal or understand that, you know, if we work towards a common objective, how much we can achieve within that framework.
That's a really profound point. Thank you so much, Earl. Carolyn, your thoughts?
Earl, you've left me feeling very optimistic about all the possibilities that are before us. I would say what China and the United States do really matters. These are the two largest carbon emitters in the world. They have made very ambitious, bold pledges. The United States to be net zero by 2050, China to be net neutral by 2060, China to peak emissions by 2030. I mean, if both countries can actually see these pledges through and remain committed, that is a significant win, not just for the United States and for China, but for the world. So I think this is, you know, goes back to something that I, you know, wrote about in my book, in our book, the use of effective climate statecraft and how both China and the United States can work towards addressing climate change, but can integrate it into its foreign and domestic policy. And I would say the same thing with around energy. As we address climate change, we also have to address the larger, you know, energy demand questions moving forward. We don't go off fossil fuels in the next 10 years, but how do we do so that we can be, you know, sharing carbon capture technologies? How can we be sort of using, I would argue, more efficiently produced and even lower carbon emitting fossil fuels that are produced here in the United States, but that can be used in China. So again, a lot of it comes down to, you know, actions and the very large, bold narratives that are now sort of driving both the United States and China going into Glasgow, that they actually can see those commitments through.
I want to see specific, meaningful bilateral agreements with quid pro quo target setting by China and the U.S. at national levels. And I want to see those agreements put forward strategically to accelerate and amplify international climate change mitigation efforts and negotiations moving forward. In 2014, the U.S. and China put out a surprising bilateral agreement, which I've referred to vaguely throughout our conversation here, which they sort of redoubled and expanded upon and added to in an agreement in 2015, just a couple of months before the Paris negotiations themselves. And the tenor of those negotiations and the atmosphere and the feeling at those meetings was different than previous COPs. And certainly different from the kinds of experiences that we'd had at less successful COPs, conferences of the parties in the past, such as in 2009 in Copenhagen, where in many ways the wheels fell off. And that is to say that the players in the negotiations all saw the difficulties ahead, but there was some confidence that because the U.S. and China, as these two major players and often opposing forces in that process, had come to this agreement publicly and specifically beforehand, expressing their mutual desire for positive negotiated outcome at Paris, that we were going to get there. And that while the shape of the ultimate outcome was still uncertain and complicated, the prospects for relative success felt high from day one in Paris. And that is actually how the outcome proceeded as well, and has allowed it to keep to continue, regardless of what you think of the agreement itself, to guide international efforts since. The US and China similarly were drivers of the relatively rapid ratification through yet another presidential agreement early in 2016. I bring this up to say that I think that these sorts of examples of climate statecraft, to borrow Caroline's term, have major implications systematically outside of just the bilateral relationship. And if we can get the sorts of nearer term target setting and material agreements in the years to come that speak to what activities are going to be taken between now and 2030, and certainly between now and mid-century, and signal less materially and almost more symbolically U.S.-China commitment to working towards those objectives, that's going to have major ripple effects on the activities that take place in other really important regions of the world. And I hope that happens.
Earl, Carolyn, Jackson, this has really been a fascinating discussion. And I want to thank all of you for your time today and for sharing your perspectives and insights on these really important issues. I appreciate it very, very much.
Thank you, David.
Thank you, David.
Thank you for having us.
Remember to look for the Bush China Foundation podcast on our website, SoundCloud, and Spotify, where you can follow our conversations. As always, thank you for listening.